where did we leave off in the last episode?
Crossing the Drake.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you...
Land ho is where we left off.
Exactly. When you get closer to land, the first land that you approach when you approach Antarctica is, or are the Shetland Islands, the South Shetland Islands to be specific.
I mean, just, I feel like I need to ask, are there other Shetland Islands?
There's Shetland Islands north of the UK, which I think are the North Shetland Islands.
Okay.
Yeah, I think.
So in Antarctica, there are the only Shetland Islands are the South Shetland Islands.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. When you cross the Drake, a good sign that you're starting to get closer to the Shetland Islands is that you start seeing lots and lots more wildlife. And that's happening for a couple of different reasons. One of the main reasons is that the colder water that is further down comes closer to the surface, and it's upwelling, which is happening because of currents that are happening underneath the surface of the water. And it's easier for cold water to mix than it is for cold and warm water to mix. So that sounds a bit strange. But no, what I mean by that is in more temperate and warmer oceans where the top layer of water, because it's closer to sunlight, is quite warm, it's harder for the water that's further down to mix with that water that's on the top. And therefore there's less nutrients in the water, there's less life in the water overall. Yeah. In the southern oceans and in the further northern oceans, because you have a lot of different cold water, the water mixes more easily, and then water which is further down is able to come to the surface, which makes the water on the surface more nutritious.
Okay, question. Yep. Why is the colder water at the bottom coming up?
It's upwelling, so it's currents that are causing it to push up. So the closer you get to land and to masses of any sort of land that come up above the surface, then it's just pushing it to the surface.
As the water gets more shallow.
Yeah, as the water gets more shallow. Yeah, that's a much better way of saying that. you then have this nutritious water coming to the surface. It's more nutritious because further down there are more nitrates and phosphates in the water, which are as a result of organisms decomposing and going down to the bottom of the ocean.
Yep.
And those nitrates and phosphates are what phytoplankton, which is the single-celled algae organism, feeds on, which in turn is then fed on by krill. And krill is really the basis for everything down in the Southern Ocean.
Yep. Pretty much everything eats krill.
Exactly. Pretty much everything eats krill. So all of these larger whale species that we're talking about.
Yeah, well, so I was going to say, so what eats krill that you start seeing then in the South Shetlands?
Yeah, so you start seeing, it's similarly to when you cross that Antarctic convergence that we mentioned in the past episode. Where the fog banks often are, where the water gets cold there, that's where you start seeing whales. And then again, when you get closer to the continental shelf off the Southern Shetland Islands, where this water comes to the surface, you start seeing a lot more fin whales, a lot more humpback whales. We've seen beaked whales there. And you even have the chance of seeing blue whales potentially, and southern right whales.
Have you seen blue whale?
I've never seen a blue whale. No. People that I've worked with have, for sure.
Man, that is crazy.
But like in large numbers, especially the fin whales and the humpback whales are
coming to feed.
Yeah, exactly. They're coming to feed.
Beyond whales?
Yeah, lots of penguins. In the South Shetlands especially, large populations of Gentoo penguins and chinstrap penguins that head out in these rafts, which might be anywhere between like 10 and 50 penguins.
Is that the collective noun?
I call them a raft. I don't know if it is the collective noun. It's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess colony when they're on land.
Yeah, but what about in the water?
In the water, a raft, yeah. And you start seeing them, and then you also start seeing seals.
Leopard.
Yeah, leopard seals would be really close to shore most of the time because of what they predate on. But you start seeing a lot of fur seals, and you get quite a lot of fur seals in the South Shetland Islands. They breed there. And then also elephant seals from time to time.
Can you just give a sense of how big these seals are? Because I feel like most people's experience with seals a lot of the time is just in aquariums, and some in the wild on the coast. But you know, seals that we're seeing here are...
Right.
You know, what's the difference in size?
Yeah, so fur seals are... they're very similar in size to the seals that we would get and see normally in most places in the world. So they're like off North America, off Europe, off Southern Africa. They're a kind of a normal sized seal that's, call it 4 to 6 feet in length.
Yeah.
You know, weigh around the same amount as the average person does. So they come in larger numbers, the fur seals, and in very large colonies as well. But then elephant seals, while they might not look
the
like
big boys.
They might not look like a huge amount in the water because you're usually just seeing the head. When they're on land, the males are as big as elephants. So I don't mean, obviously they're not as tall. You know, they look like a sausage rock, we call them.
Yeah, a couch, a sofa.
Like a sofa, although you shouldn't sit on them and don't sit on them. but like a big adult male elephant seal will weigh as
like
much
4 tons.
As an adult female elephant.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Jesus. 4, even slightly more tons. Those are obviously just
crazy.
The biggest, the Beachmasters. And we'll talk a lot more about elephant seals in when we talk about South Georgia in one of the next episodes. But when you start seeing these bigger congregations of whales and, you know, these rafts of penguins especially, you... In like higher concentrations and densities, you know that you're getting close to land.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually you do see land, and it's you know, it's a bit of a buzz on the ship. We always try and make sure that everyone gets outside, and when land is first spotted, that, you know, there's an announcement made so that everyone gets outside. It's also, you also start seeing a lot more ice and a lot more icebergs in the water. And you know, people have a general idea as to when we will reach land, or when we will have land ho or land in sight. And it's just, it's really incredible, because when you realize you're there, it's, you know, you're in a place that you've never been. And even, you know, I've done it a few times now. There's just always an excitement because of where you know you are in the world.
You've done the Drake, and now kind of the wildlife adventure part of it really begins.
Exactly. And, so unfortunately, the Shetlands are, you know, the weather is not always very good in the South Shetlands. You often have high winds. You often have like rain and snow, or a cross between the two. Sleet, yeah. Yeah.
Such nice weather.
Lovely
cold
weather. But it's a good opportunity for people to kind of get into their outer layers and into their outer gear to prepare and kind of understand what conditions are like, because the conditions are pretty similar in the Shetlands to what they are on the peninsula. But
can be, yeah.
Yeah. I think the thing that strikes anyone that sees the Shetlands the first is what they look like. And the Shetlands look pretty similar to the Antarctic Peninsula.
Right.
The mountains maybe aren't quite as tall or as steep, especially, but you have mostly glaciated islands. And you have these very jagged rocks that are sticking up out of the sea and form part of the land. And you just know this is a place where people are not supposed to live. You just know this is not somewhere where people...
We're not adapted to it.
Are adapted to live, exactly.
Any standout sightings for you that you've had in the South Shetlands?
Yeah, definitely. I think, so we'll talk about what you see when you start going on shore in the Shetlands.
Mm-hmm.
Or when you leave the ship, because now you are leaving the ship for the first time and you're going on an excursion, you're going on an expedition. And what that entails is us as the guiding team, we get into the water first on our Zodiacs. So these Zodiacs are these small inflatable boats that are very, very good at, it's very easy to get them off a ship and into the water. You can land with them, you know, virtually anywhere because they're inflatables. And they have a very shallow draft, so you can get into, like, you can land them on a beach.
Yep.
And once we're in the water and we've done our, like, safety checks that all our equipment is working properly, and we know that conditions are favorable, then we'll get the guests out into the water as well.
And the guests have done their whole suit up on the boat.
Exactly. So the guests have suited up.
Oh, God. On the ship.
On the ship. Correct. So... What that looks like if you're a guest or if you're a guide is you need to be fully waterproof. Your outer layer needs to be...
Yeah, what are you wearing?
Yeah, your outer layer needs to be fully waterproof. And I would liken it again kind of to skiing, in that you know, you've got waterproof pants on, a waterproof outer shell, and below that is stuff to keep you warm. So you've got a mid layer, like, which is usually a fleece or puffer jacket of some kind. Then you've got a base layer or two. And then also below your, like, we, most of us wear these like sailing bibs or these outer trousers. And then you've got like a, what are they called? Long johns below.
Base layer.
Exactly. And sometimes even a fleece pant if it's a very cold day. And then most of us wear these muck boots, and all the guests are provided with muck boots. Which are these very waterproof, very warm
rain boots.
Rain boots, exactly. Yeah. So.
And then you've got the bright colored outer layer parka that every guest is wearing.
That's it. Yeah. So the guests are all one color, and then the guides are all another color. And you know, it depends which company you're going to go down to Antarctica with, but those colors vary.
Yeah.
But it's always so that you can easily, in bad conditions, also identify, oh, that's a guide, or oh, that's a guest.
Yeah.
Now
that person is supposed to be there, that person is not supposed to be there.
Yeah, exactly. Getting onto a zodiac for the first time is also quite interesting, because you know, if conditions are perfect and calm, it's really, really quite simple. You just step onto the pontoon, and you know, the sailors who are on the ship are helping you off the ship, and the guide is helping you onto the zodiac. But conditions in the Shetlands especially are not always super favorable, which means that like you might have a little bit of swell. And the zodiac is moving, it's bobbing up and down with the water next to whatever platform or like marina deck there is that you are on, that's kind of protruding from the ship. So it's an adventure, you know, it's a real adventure, and it's good to go on this excursion regardless of like what the conditions are.
Yeah, I mean, get off the boat,
get off the ship, exactly.
Go see what you see.
Yeah, go see what you can find.
Okay,
and then,
so what are you, well, proceed, but I want to know what you're looking for there.
Yeah, so the first thing that you'll do, it depends on how many guests are on a ship, but if there's more than 100 guests on the ship, you're going to have half of the people going on a zodiac cruise, which means you're just staying on the water, and then the other half is going to go straight to shore and do a landing. We call the shore landings, where you're generally walking to an area that has wildlife, like a penguin colony. Mm-hmm.
Do you switch like halfway through that activity, or
exactly?
Oh, you do. Okay.
Yeah, you
so
do.
So everyone's
exactly.
getting on land.
Yeah.
And everyone's getting to do a boat cruise.
Exactly.
Or
yeah.
A zodiac cruise.
Exactly. So it's, you know, it's kind of 1 to 2 hours of each. So your
Perfect.
Zodiac cruise would be 1 to 2 hours, and then the landing would also be 1 to 2 hours, and that's simply because any longer than that, and you start getting cold, even on like good days.
I mean,
most,
4 hours outside, I'd be cold.
Yeah, most people start getting cold. And on the Zodiac, you're not moving much, which means that, you know, you get colder on the Zodiac, and everyone just needs to...
Well, I imagine it's windier if you're cruising along.
Totally, it is windier, yeah.
It's like an early morning game drive in the snow.
Yeah, exactly. So the first landing and the first excursion from the Shetlands can be pretty overwhelming, because now you're getting comfortable in your outer gear and all of your waterproof stuff. It's probably... pretty cold, you know, you're sitting on this Zodiac for the first time, and you're sitting on the pontoon. There's no seats, so you're sitting on the outside of the boat. Obviously you're given proper safety briefings while, you know, still while on the ship, while crossing the Drake, and you're also given safety briefings by your driver and by your guide. So that would be me or one of the other expedition team members. But it is overwhelming. You're also in this foreign environment, and this environment which looks like nothing else that you've ever seen.
It's a lot to take in.
And, you know, so the focus isn't always on that first excursion to see as much as possible, because the excursion in itself is already so much.
Right.
That being said,
get comfortable on the boat.
Yeah. That being said, there are so many things to see in the Shetlands. And there is a lot of wildlife in the Shetlands. Because the Shetlands become... ice-free sooner than the Antarctic Peninsula.
Just because they're further north?
Exactly, they're further north. They're just like a few degrees further north, which means that there are more suitable nesting sites for penguins that are available.
Earlier.
Exactly, yes, that are available sooner in the season. And the ocean around the Shetlands becomes completely ice-free much sooner than the oceans around the Antarctic Peninsula.
And that's good for the, like, predatory, so like the leopard, seal,
exactly, yeah, it's
orca.
good for all the above. Yeah, it's good for orca. I've had some very, very good orca sightings in the South
Epic.
Shetland Islands. It's probably as productive for orcas as the peninsula is, and these are the areas on the planet that have the highest concentrations of orca.
So cool.
Yeah, so it's really amazing. When you get on land, you get a little briefing by the expedition leader or by the person who's in control of the beach, and they tell you, you know, where you can and you can't walk. The routes that you can walk are flagged by the guides, and usually they'll have like a focal point, like a penguin colony, or there might be some seals of any description that are hauled out on the beach. And that's when the action really starts.
Yeah,
because so we start the Antarctic season at the end of October, early November, and at that point the breeding season in the South Shetlands is well underway. And that means
because there's exposed land.
Exactly, there's exposed land. It's mostly rock, so there's very, very little vegetation. The only vegetation really is moss in some places, but that's kind of it.
I'm sure there's a scientist somewhere that knows everything there is to know about that moss.
Yeah, definitely. And you walk, it's generally going to be a little bit of an uphill because the penguins nest a little bit off the beach most of the time. And at elevation, because again, that's the areas that are ice-free soonest. And then these penguin colonies, they vary in size. So you can have some penguin colonies that are just like 20 to 30 individuals. Those are small, very small colonies. And then you have colonies that have thousands of penguins at them. And we try and obviously visit penguins colonies that are a little bit bigger. But you get there, and one of the first things I think that you notice is A, the noise.
So loud. Are they smelly?
It's very, very noisy. And B, the smell.
Yeah.
Because it's very, very smelly.
I mean, I'm just thinking of like a seal colony. It's like overwhelmingly stinky.
Yeah. Don't shit where you eat. These guys do all the above. Yeah. So you have these penguins,
which types?
You have chin straps mostly there. And then you have big colonies of Gentoo penguins as well. And they build these nests. These colonies are reestablished year after year in the same spots, which means that same individuals will use the same nests, even sometimes even with the same partner.
Cute.
over various breeding seasons. And
I had never really thought about this, and I think it's specific penguins are, but on the whole, are penguins generally monogamous?
I would say serially monogamous or seasonally monogamous. Which means that they, you know, you're led to believe, or I think a lot of popular culture leads you to believe, that penguins are exclusively monogamous. That's not true.
I guess I think of that with emperors.
With emperors, yeah. Emperors probably would be more monogamous.
So, yeah.
But that being said, if a penguin has breeding success with an individual one season, there is a good chance they will mate and partner up again with that penguin the next season.
Yeah.
That being said, if they're not successful, that might not necessarily happen. So there's not really any specific rule of thumb to it. But they will stay with that same partner for the whole duration of the breeding season. Yeah. And if you say breeding season, you say from when they come to shore first, because they spend the rest of the year at sea. They're not really on land. It depends a little bit on the species, obviously. But most of the Antarctic penguins would spend the vast majority of their year
exhausting.
At sea. Exhausting. They have such exhausting lives. But when they come on shore, it's usually the older males that arrive first because they know the breeding grounds the best. They'll start building up the nests. The females arrive a little bit after that, like a few days afterwards. And by that point, the males have hopefully established the nests already. And then mating happens very shortly after that. And then very shortly after that, do they start laying their eggs.
Incubation period is...
Yeah, so once they lay the eggs,
yeah.
Most of these species that we're mentioning now, so the chinstrap, the Gentoo and the Adelie, so they're the brush-tailed penguins, they lay two eggs. In fact, the only penguin species that only lay one egg are the royal, so the larger penguins, the kings and the emperors.
Yeah, okay, good. That was my guess.
Yeah, and they only lay one egg. Well, the kings might only lay one egg every 2 years or two eggs every 3 years.
Jeepers.
Yeah, so, you know, their breeding cycles are quite fragile. And we'll get into that more a little bit later on. But
South G.
Yeah, exactly, South G. When you get to this penguin colony for the first time, again, you notice the noise. You can imagine they're very, very vocal at these large colonies. One of the best ways for them to identify their partner is by vocalizing. And you know, if you have several thousand penguins and they're all vocalizing at the same time,
oh boy,
it's loud. Yeah, it's really loud. I often get asked when I'm at the colony, like, how do they recognize each other, and the way that I explain that is, well, they just know the voice of their partner. To us, it sounds...
No, it doesn't even sound that crazy, because you think of it, if you're in a crowd of like 300 people and your mom is like, Hadley, Hadley, I'm going to recognize that.
100%.
It might take me a while to hear her over the noise, but as soon as I hear it, I'll know it.
That's exactly what I always say. So I always say, like, my gran has a very kind of penetrating voice. You know, she's just kind of like a loud enough person. And I just always say, like, I could pick her voice out of 1,000 people.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's exactly how they do it. So you might get to a colony, and the likelihood is, and what happened this season and last season is that the first time I got to these colonies, they were already eggs, and the eggs were not hatched yet.
Yep.
But it takes, so the incubation period you were asking about is generally speaking between 30 and 35 days. So just over a month for most of these smaller penguin species, the brush-tailed penguins. And then they have two eggs which hatch, you know, a day or two apart, usually maybe 2 to 3 days. And the brush-tailed penguins, the chin straps and the gentoos will try and raise both of those chicks. They'll try and allow both of those eggs to hatch, and they'll try and raise both of those chicks with equal parenting.
I don't know if you know this or not, but do you know those two eggs, are they considered... This is getting, I guess, very nitty-gritty, but are they considered twins if they're, like, being incubated and born at the same time? Or because they're different eggs, are they just siblings that are the same age?
I would consider them siblings.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a litter of
right,
animals.
Right, a litter of puppies.
Yeah.
Right.
A similar thing.
Yep.
But where was I with that? So because the eggs will, you know, they'll generally hatch a bit later in the season. Mm. There's still a lot of action, and the one thing that to me I find so impressive and that really resonates with me is that when you get to these colonies, they're really, you're seeing the full circle of life, and you might see that in just one excursion. So you might have eggs which are being incubated, you might even have hatching eggs at a certain point.
You might see penguins breeding.
You might see penguins mating, so the younger penguins which get to these colonies a little bit later. Generally, when I say something like that, I'm usually, it's generalizing a little bit. But if you have mating penguins at the same time as there are eggs already, those penguins who are mating are usually younger. You know, it might be their first year or their second year only breeding. Mm-hmm. And the older they get, the more success they have.
So they're breeding, others are
incubating
eggs.
Yeah. And then you have predation, which is occurring, which comes in the form of two different birds, especially, well, three, I guess. You have skuas, so brown skuas.
The dreaded skuas.
Yeah, or subantarctic or south polar skuas. And then you have the giant petrels, which are these big, nasty-looking birds. Skuas I would liken to a gull. So a skua is the same sort of size as your average gull.
They're brown?
Completely brown in color, exactly. But the same sort of beak structure. And if you know or have ever observed a gull, you'll know that a gull is a very opportunistic...
Yeah, non-discriminant eater.
eater and predator. So they'll go for absolutely anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the skuas in the South Shetland Islands and on the Arctic Peninsula, but the skuas on the South Shetland Islands have become very good at, you know, understanding what the penguin's breeding cycle is. And they're very good at stealing penguin eggs.
So sad.
Yeah. So we went to a place called the Echo Islands and an island called Barrientos, which is in the South Shetlands, several times this season. And we had really good luck, if you can describe it as luck, seeing a lot of this predation occurring. And these skuas have gotten so clever. So the skuas will often work in pairs. They're also monogamous.
Mm-hmm.
And the skuas are going through their own breeding season at the same time. So they are... You know, they're really desperately trying to get as much food as they can. And the one skua might try and distract the penguin from the front.
The penguin parent.
The penguin parent. And usually the penguin... At a penguin nest, there will only be one adult. You know, there's overlap
at
a time. And both male and female incubate the egg. So, and you don't know which one is male or female because they look the same. But they incubate equally. And the one parent will be on the nest and the other parent will likely be out at sea looking for food.
Yeah.
So that means that you have one adult defending the nest and defending two eggs at the start of the season. And then you have potentially two skuas that are trying to nab these eggs from the penguin. So on Barrientos, we observed this, like, I think on two different days this past season, and many eggs were taken. It was like, it's sad to see, because you know the stress that these penguins have gone through to get to this point, just to get to this point. And then you have one skua coming from the front, and from the back you have the second skua, and these skuas would grab the penguin by the tail feathers, tail feathers, and they would yank the penguin off the nest, and then the skua at the front would grab the egg and run off with the egg. It was brutal. Really brutal.
So upsetting.
And then, to add insult to injury, than injury, the skuas pick the egg in their beak, and then they put it down. They just move like 5 meters off.
Oh, no.
And in front of the penguin adult. Because once the egg has been lost, the penguin parent doesn't do any more defending. So, and it can defend very well against the skua or whatever predator is in front of it by like jabbing with its beak. Yeah. Which often does deter the skua in front, but it can't do anything against the one from behind. And if there's two skuas working together, it's very hard. And these skuas have a really high success rate. Then these skuas use their beak to like drill or jab into the egg, which sometimes takes a couple of taps, and then they just eat what's inside the egg. And it goes really, really quick. But it is heartbreaking.
Brutal.
But it is also amazing
to see.
Skuas
gotta eat.
Skuas have gotta eat. So that's one thing for me that like I find it makes such an lasting impression, is that you're seeing mating, you're seeing eggs that are being incubated, you're seeing sometimes hatching. I'll get into that in another episode. You're seeing eventually these very, very young penguins, which are these just tiny little gray and black fluff balls.
So freaking cute.
Nest. And that's really awesome also, is that you're seeing these sometimes day old penguins, and you know that they're a day or two old, because sometimes you see a little chick and you see the egg next to it, which means that the first egg is hatched.
Oh, so cute.
But the second egg hasn't hatched. And then you'll actually see the parent regurgitating and feeding the youngster. And what that looks like is actually the chick encouraging the adult to regurgitate food, which is most likely going to be krill.
It's like the wild dog pups.
Yeah, so they tickle the underside of the beak or the side of the beak of the adult.
Yeah.
They tickle until the adult starts to like almost convulse and regurgitate this food for the youngster.
So sweet.
Yeah, it
very
is.
Very full circle of life.
Exactly. Now, that regurgitating of food also attracts other bird species, including a bird called a sheathbill. So sheathbill looks like a cross between a pigeon and a chicken. And it's the only bird. It's completely white. It's the only bird that you find down in Antarctica and in the Shetlands that doesn't have webbed toes. So it's the only, or webbed feet. It's the only bird that isn't really a true like pelagic or seabird. Exactly.
And they live there year round, or they're coming from South America.
They'll come from South America for the summer months.
To eat penguins.
To eat. They also grab the eggs if they can. They will feed on this regurgitation.
Mm.
And the kind of joke is that the sheathbill is also called the shitbill, because they feed on the feces of the penguins. Yeah, they're nasty little birds.
Goodness.
They look nasty.
Very pigeony.
Very primitive looking, actually. Yeah, their face is quite primitive looking. Really, really interesting bird, and very different to the other birds that you find down there.
Also, just to say, with each of these podcasts, we always put a blog out as well. So if you want to see photos and videos of the stuff that we talk about, they'll be in there. So we'll put a photo of the sheathbill on the blog.
Exactly, yeah. I realize that I've talked about this for a very long time. So let's move on to the kind of next, like, really cool thing about the Shetlands, which is, in my eyes and in many people's eyes, Deception Island. So Deception Island is...
Love the name.
Yeah.
Seems very cool.
It's not truly an island. It's actually a massive volcanic caldera that has... and it's about 10 kilometers in diameter, so huge.
Yep.
That has an opening that is, you know, only a couple of hundred meters across. Really, really narrow. And that has water going into it, so you sail into a volcano.
Sweet.
It's one of the only places in the world, maybe actually the only place in the world, that you're able to sail via the ocean into a volcano. This volcano is active. It's had eruptions in the 20th century. It's had a minor eruption in the 21st century, I think.
Sweet.
And it's relatively ice-free also. There are large colonies of chinstrap penguins. There are some gentoos. And there are seals. Lots and lots of fur seals. So one of the cool things there is that you might, if you come at the right time of year, again, kind of earlier in the season, you might have little, or not earlier in the season, like mid-season, you'll have these fur seal pups which are on the beach and that are, you know, playing around.
Stanky as well.
Also a bit stanky, but playing around in the shallows and kind of exploring their swimming skills and diving skills for the first time. And I have a little GoPro camera on a stick, which Hadley absolutely loves. And when I'm down there, I like to put that in underwater because these fur seals are very curious and they like coming up right to the zodiac and almost interacting with the zodiac in a very playful way.
It's like a big seal.
Yeah, so I had one really cool sighting, which was you land. There's various places you can land on Deception Island. One is the main whaling station, so Deception Island, because it is this very protected volcanic caldera cone, was a site for a lot of whaling activity in the kind of early to mid 20th century, because it's so protected and sheltered. And the fur seal populations have really recovered in recent years. So there's, you know, because
they
it's ice free.
Also hunt seal.
Exactly. Sorry? Say that again?
Seal? What, you said the Cape Fur seal populations have really recovered.
Yeah, so there used to be a lot of sealing also. So sealing kind
to
of
the whaling.
Yeah, started much earlier, started in the like early 19th century when people were first going down and discovering these areas for the first time. That's when the sealing was also occurring, because a lot of these people, as we discussed in a previous episode, were sealers.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this recovering population of seals that's not as afraid of humans anymore as they once were, that like to come and interact with the zodiacs, but are still hesitant. And it really makes for quite the scene and quite the spectacle.
You said you had a sighting that stood out to you there.
Yeah, so across from the whaling station, there's this really big beach. And I remember driving there with some guests. And when I say driving, I mean driving the zodiac there. We call ourselves drivers, or we call it driving a zodiac. And on this beach across from the whaling station, there must have been, you know, 100 fur seals or so,
mm-hmm.
with lots of youngsters and lots of kind of, not teenagers, but, you know, they were slightly older already. This was actually towards the end of last season. And I remember this just like group of teenagers coming, and like, you could just see the one egging the other one on and saying like, get closer to the boat, get closer to the boat. Or get closer to the zodiac, the zode. And like, I stuck my camera under the water and got some nice footage. And yeah, the guests were absolutely loving it also, because it's really interactive.
So,
you know,
sweet.
They come up and they like make eye contact with you, and they have these big,
hello.
These big fluffy whiskers, these long whiskers.
They look like dogs.
Yeah,
like
they
dogs
do.
Dogs of the ocean.
They kind of remind me of otters almost as well.
Mm.
And they're just very agile in the water.
Playful.
And move very quickly, which is nice. Another cool thing that you can do on Deception is you can go for proper walks, because a lot of it is, there is a glacier there, or there are one or two glaciers on Deception, but there's also large portions of the land mass that have no snow or ice on them at all. And we went for this really, really cool hike in a place called Telephone Bay, where we did like, you know, probably like 3 or 4 kilometers of walking on land, which is a lot. You don't generally walk that far because you're restricted by ice. And, you know, safety concerns. And we got there this season, like also kind of towards the end of my season, excuse me, and it had snowed the night before, but it hadn't snowed like a huge amount. There was this like lovely sprinkling of white that made it like, it almost looked like a bit of an impressionist painting. It was amazing. And we got to hike through this area and go and see, you know, like some of the really cool geographical features. And it was just a great way to stretch the legs after having been, you know, at sea for such a long time.
Yeah, on the Drake.
So that really, really stood out to me too. All right, so I realize we haven't actually gotten to Antarctica fully on this episode, but we've gotten to the South Shetlands and we've left the ship. Next episode,
where are we heading?
We're heading south. We're heading to the peninsula, and I promise we're going to leave the ship and we're going to go on some excursions, and I'll talk about some of the sightings that I've had down on the peninsula, and we're really going to get into some more of the action, because
and South G,
and that's where it pops off, and later in the season we'll get to South G, to South Georgia, but I
wildlife
think
mecca,
the
South
wildlife
G.
The wildlife mecca, but more sightings to come in the next episode, and thanks again for joining us this time and making it this far through all the waffle about skuas and penguins. And see you next time.